is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofo, and here's what's coming up.
Failure to follow the 8 guidelines we have given, ministry will have no choice, and we shall not have any option but to close the major three legs by December 2021.
That was Adoa Helen, Uganda's Minister of Fisheries, on the government's threat to close major bodies of water if fishermen don't follow new guidelines on best practices. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Under domestic and international pressure, Tunisian President Kais Saied asked a little-known professor of geophysics with little government experience to form a government as quickly as possible. Saied dismissed the former prime minister, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority in July. Last week, he said he will rule by decree. William Lawrence, professor of politics at American University in Washington, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawy the choice of new prime minister Najla Boudin Romdane, who implemented World Bank projects at the Ministry of Education, and her role with the president exerting expanded powers.
He has jailed many of his opponents, fired most of the government, including firing the whole IMF negotiating team and not replacing them. And he assumed legislative and judicial authorities as well. So he seized all three branches of government. Second, I know this professor well. She's a decent person. She's a lot better than him in most respects. She does have government experience and reached a high position in the Ministry of Higher Education and Scientific Research, where she's been in charge of the projects that you mentioned, the World Bank projects. She just has very little experience with parliamentary and presidential politics, with political parties and with all the political deals that are a major feature of Tunisia's democratic transition. So she has a lot to learn. I have full confidence in her as a leader, but she can only succeed if this president gives her any authority. And so far, many people are saying she will just be window dressing for his desire to rule by decree like a Napoleon. So her ability to succeed, which is critically important to the future of Tunisia and the future of Libya and the entire region, will depend on her ability to negotiate power from the president and then use it wisely. It'll be a difficult job. She won't have a parliament behind her, I don't think. And I hope she gives it her best effort. She's smart, she's uncorrupted, and President Saied does respond fairly well to women. A lot of his closest advisors are women, and I'm hopeful for her sake and Tunisia's sake that she succeeds. But so far, this president has done almost nothing for me to have faith in him.
Last week, a statement from the UGTT said, "We consider the president has lost his legitimacy by violating the constitution. Would that lead to an effective opposition push to restore democracy in Tunisia?"
Tunisia's crisis is worse in part because the government is in a fiscal crisis. And that is in part because most of the national budget goes to salaries. And UGTT wants even more money for salaries. In addition, the UGTT privately presented Saied a roadmap of 4 points in August. And the roadmap was unimaginative and a non-starter. They've also refused to talk to the other members of the quartet with whom they won the Nobel Prize in 2015 for helping negotiate Tunisia out of another political crisis that began in 2013. But now they're doing none of the things they did in 2013. So they really have not been helpful at all in advocating for political reform, except for supporting the president until they changed their mind last week and decided not to support it. I don't think the UGTT will organize the opposition. They haven't been doing it so far. But it is true that the two most important institutions in the country are the UGTT and the army. There were reports yesterday that the army had moved its tanks away from parliament, which would be an excellent development. But the president is talking to very few Tunisians, mostly foreign delegations, to whom he keeps just explaining and explaining that this is not a coup. Ultimately, it will probably take larger protests to dislodge him or to move him in a positive direction. And then the action of the army will be very important. But because he's so stubborn, we don't know who can convince him to do anything. And so we have to right now put our hopes that the people inside his circle of power can convince him of things, including Najmuddin Ramdan, in consultation with others rather than just the labor movement.
The political crisis generated by Tunisian President Kais Saied has caused great turmoils within the country's largest party, Ennahda. 113 prominent Ennahda members, among them former ministers and members of the parliament, announced their resignation. Could that lead to excluding Islamists from the Tunisian political scene?
Not that, no. What will exclude these Islamists, who now call themselves Muslim Democrats, from the political scene is Kais Saied getting rid of all political parties, which he wants to do, and to recreate the entire Tunisian political system in the image of Gaddafi's Jamahiriya system, a kind of utopian and dystopian system of direct democracy, where each representative is a local king who Saied imagines will be uncorrupted and will have no affiliations to anything but himself. That's what will exclude Mehda, this professor implementing his vision. The resignations, by contrast, are a sign of internal democracy within the party, as Mehda is the most internally democratic party in Tunisia, despite the fact that their leader has, you know, been there since its foundation. However, if Saied continues down this path of dictatorship, he will ban all the parties and he will continue to repress all parties and any organization that speaks against him.
That was William Lawrence, professor of politics at American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. 15 African countries have succeeded in fully vaccinating at least 10% of their populations against COVID-19 by September 30th, a goal set by the World Health Organization in May. However, that leaves two-thirds of the continent's 54 nations extremely vulnerable to the deadly disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Several countries have performed extremely well. Seychelles and Mauritius have fully vaccinated more than 60% of their populations, and Morocco has inoculated 48% against the coronavirus. Richard Mahigo is coordinator of the Vaccine Preventable Diseases Department in the WHO's Regional Office for Africa. He says those countries were able to achieve and even exceed the 10% target because they had a steady vaccine supply available. He says most had the money to strike bilateral deals to procure vaccine in addition to the supplies delivered through the COVAX facility.
Unfortunately, 70% of African countries have missed this important milestone to protect their most vulnerable, with half of the 52 countries with COVID vaccination program in Africa have inoculated less than 2% of their population.
That compares to an inoculation rate of 50% or higher in wealthier countries. The WHO reports monthly vaccine deliveries to Africa have increased tenfold since June. However, it notes more than double that amount is needed to reach the 40% immunization target of Africa's 1.3 billion people by the end of the year. Mahigo says COVAX is identifying countries that do not have the means to procure vaccines and put them in the front of the line to get enough doses to cover the most at-risk populations. However, he says pledges of doses by wealthier countries need to materialize soon.
Starting next week, we are sending multidisciplinary teams of international experts to countries that are struggling to scale up their operation so that we can drill down and identify the bottlenecks so that the local authorities and their partners can remedy them as they continue to roll out the vaccine.
On a more positive note, the World Health Organization says COVID-19 infections in Africa dropped by 35% to just over 74,000 last week, with more than 1,700 deaths reported in 34 countries. Despite the declining numbers, the WHO warns people must remain vigilant and continue to adhere to proven public health measures to save lives. Those include the wearing of masks, regular hand washing, and physical distancing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's Special Investigating Unit, or SIU, has found that the country's health department has been riddled with corruption related to COVID-19 contracts since the beginning of the pandemic in March last year. It's released a report that implicates 19 individuals, including former Health Minister Zweli Mkhize, in a multi-million dollar graft. Opposition parties and civil society groups say the findings are more evidence that the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, remains corrupt to the core. Darren Taylor reports.
The SIU report finds that Mkhize and his senior officials awarded a COVID-19 communications tender worth about 150 million rands, or $11 million, to ANC friends. The company involved Digital Vibes was paid massive amounts for simple tasks, such as arranging media briefings, tasks that should have been performed by Mkhize's own communications team. The SIU says Mkhize pocketed 6 million rands from the fraudulent deal. Investigators say Digital Vibes also bought an SUV for the then minister's son and paid for extensive renovations to Mkhize's home. The former minister denies he's corrupt in any way. The SIU completed the report 4 months ago, but President Cyril Ramaphosa only released it yesterday, following pressure from the Opposition Democratic Alliance, or DA, and especially from its shadow health minister, Siviwe Gwarube.
What is shocking for me, I think, more than what is in the report, is how we can have South Africa going through the deadliest pandemic, and we have at the helm of the health response in this country, the minister and his senior management accused of such grave, grave grand theft.
She points out that while COVID-19 was killing tens of thousands of South Africans, Mkhize and his team were allegedly stealing public money meant to prevent further infections and deaths. The SIU report names Mkhize's former Director General, Dr. Anban Pillay, as guilty of fraud, which he denies. UNIT spokesman Kaiser Khanyaho says it's now up to the National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, to decide whether to pursue similar charges against Mkhize and others. Khanyaho says the Treasury Department initially vetoed the appointment of Digital Vibes, forcing corrupt Health Department officials to circumvent the law.
When they could not appoint Digital Vibes before, because Treasury did not agree for them to deviate, they then did what we now know is a mock kind of SCM process, where they went and got 10 companies in the data central database to bid for this contract. And obviously one of those companies was Digital Vibes. Out of that 10, only two of them responded to the request, and it was Digital Vibes and one other. The other one that was charging less and had more experience was disqualified because there was a manipulation of the information that was there and also the marks that are given.
Gwarube commends the SIU for an excellent job, but says the true test of Ramaphosa's commitment to fight ANC graft is yet to come.
It is now absolutely critical that the people that I call the Digital Vibes for, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, Dr. Anban Pillay, the current DG, Dr. Sandile Mutelezi, and Mr. Ian van der Merwe, all need to be handed over to the NPA for a criminal investigation.
She says Ramaphosa must stop trying to find political solutions to criminal problems.
The reality is that a crime has been committed, and the fact that the minister has stepped down does not absolve him from being held accountable. And that's why now the NPA needs to step in swiftly, investigate him, and whoever is found to be guilty needs to be sent to jail.
Ramaphosa has repeatedly said his prosecutors will target corrupt ANC officials, even if they're friends. The DA says it's time for a president who some in his own party have branded weak to prove that he has strength of character. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
An American expert on Sudan today said there are credible threats in the country after 11 terrorists of various nationalities were arrested in Khartoum following a raid and gunfight 2 days ago that killed 5 members of Sudan's General Intelligence Service. Authorities say 4 other members of the terrorist cell escaped. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Washington.
Sudanese authorities announced late Tuesday that two officers and three non-commissioned officers of Sudan's General Intelligence Service were killed during a raid that targeted a terrorist cell in Khartoum's Jabra neighborhood. A statement on the state-run Sudan news agency says the gunned-down officers were part of a unit tracking ISIS-affiliated terrorist groups in Khartoum. The head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and his deputy, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, attended the funeral prayers of the slain officers at the Sudan Armed Forces Mosque in Khartoum late Tuesday. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok tweeted on his official page offering his deepest condolences to the families of the martyrs who gave their lives defending the stability and people of our country, adding that our people shall never fall prey of terrorism that has plunged other countries into chaos and violence. The head of Sudan's transitional government also called on security and police institutions to, in his words, intensify efforts to prevent any attempt to undermine and destabilize our country, which is opening up and progressing at all levels. Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, a former chief of staff of the office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan at the State Department, and former director of Africa at the White House.
There are very genuine security threats in the country. And those security threats require a competent, capable, and professional security service to confront them. That much is not in doubt. I think the challenge that Sudan faces today is beyond these legitimate threats, what is the role of the armed forces.
Hudson says Tuesday's incident and last week's failed coup attempt should not be used by Sudan's military to undermine the civilian-led government of Prime Minister Hamdok.
This will likely be used by the military to demonstrate that they need to have a prominent role in running the country. And again, I think that cases like yesterday just further underscore the need for a comprehensive conversation on security sector reform and the role of the military in the country going forward.
Military and civilian officials in Sudan's transitional government traded accusations about what led up to last week's failed coup attempt. Observers say the situation has exposed a fragile military-civilian partnership in Sudan's government. Last year, Prime Minister Hamdok survived an assassination attempt when his motorcade was targeted with explosives while on his way to the office. Hudson says it is not clear if the most recent events are connected to the assassination attempt.
We don't really know how this connects to the assassination attempt last year. My sense is that it is separate, that there are former regime elements, Islamist elements of the former regime, which remain present in the country. I do not think that they are the same as Islamic State cells. I think that there's been no demonstration that there's overlap between the elements of the former regime and more hardcore terrorist, international terrorist elements. That link has not been established.
Former Sudan President Omar al-Bashir hosted various terrorist groups and leaders, including the head of the Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, prompting the United States government to label Sudan a terrorist state. Sudan was found guilty of supporting Al-Qaeda attacks on U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya in 1998, as well as a bomb attack on the USS Cole off the coast of Yemen in 2000. Under the new transitional government following the Sudanese revolution and Bashir's ouster in 2019, Sudan was removed from the U.S. state sponsors of terrorism. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
David Malpass is making the first visit to Sudan by a World Bank president in more than 50 years, calling it a sign that the country's integration into the international community is, quote, progressing in strides, unquote. After meeting with Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, Malpass said, quote, Sudan is making a transition from violent situation, from a situation of shortages, to the situation that is gradually improving, unquote. He urged patience as the country makes the transition to democracy from decades of autocratic rule and tries to reduce poverty, boost economic growth, shrink the massive budget deficit, and reduce shortages of essential goods. Sudan recently cleared its overdue payments to the World Bank, giving the government access to new types of international financing for the first time in nearly three decades. While in Sudan, Malpass is giving a virtual address to the annual meeting of the financial institution and the International Monetary Fund. Ethiopia is holding elections today in the final round of voting for dozens of federal parliamentary seats. Results aren't expected at least October 10th, and AFP reported they are unlikely to have any impact on the balance of power in parliament or the new government that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is expected to form next week. Abiy's Prosperity Party secured a new five-year term with a landslide winning national polls in June, taking 410 seats out of 436. But no voting occurred in the northernmost Tigray region, the site of a brutal conflict that erupted in November, and 83 races elsewhere were delayed due to either logistical or security issues. The largest opposition party in Somali region, the Ogaden National Liberation Front, announced earlier this month it would not participate in today's polls, citing suspected irregularities in the registration process. Botswana is celebrating 55 years of independence today, with President Mokgweetsi Masisi hailing the country's efforts to build COVID-19. Botswana is one of only 14 African countries to meet the World Health Organization's target of vaccinating at least 10% of the population by the end of September. From Gaborone, Botswana, reporter Nkondisi Dube has the details.
In his Independence Day speech, Masisi said despite subdued celebrations, the country is making progress in blunting the spread of the pandemic. There were no official celebrations to mark Independence Day due to COVID-19 restrictions, but the country exits an 18-month-old state of emergency today.
Today we celebrate the 55th anniversary of independence. Not with pomp and ceremony, as we have always done prior to the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic. The year 2021 was the worst year for almost every nation, as many people lost their lives to the pandemic.
However, he says there is hope for a better future as the country ramps up COVID-19 vaccination. It has fully vaccinated 235,000 people, or 13.2% of the eligible population. After meeting the WHO target, Masisi says the aim is to inoculate at least 64% of the population by the end of December. Only 14 out of 54 countries have managed to vaccinate at least 10% of their eligible populations.
Despite the challenges we've encountered in acquiring the vaccines due to global shortage, Botswana is one of Africa's top-ranked countries, which have so far fulfilled the World Health Organization target of vaccinating at least 10% of the eligible population. My government's plan is to vaccinate at least 64% of our population by December 2021.
Masisi says the infection rate has dropped significantly in recent weeks, prompting a decision to end the state of emergency in a bid to reopen the economy.
The improvement in the COVID-19 situation that we are experiencing has made the reopening of the economy possible. It is on the basis of the improvements that I found it befitting to opt for the exit from the state of public emergency, which coincidentally ends on our national day.
Businesses will revert to pre-COVID-19 operating times starting tomorrow. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Okwo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05.